from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. A recent UCSF study revealed flaws in the way anorexia nervosa, the deadliest psychiatric disorder, is treated. Based on 40 years of data, the analysis found that commonly used treatments, including drugs and cognitive behavioral therapy, did not have better results than standard supportive counseling. We'll hear about the report, discuss where current treatments might be missing the mark, and discuss new approaches that may move anorexia treatment past its long-standing plateau. That's all coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Eating disorders are the most deadly of all psychiatric illnesses, affecting close to 30 million Americans. That's according to the National Eating Disorders Association. But a new study finds that treatment for disorders like anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating hasn't improved in nearly 40 years. We're going to discuss the UCSF study and the most promising new avenues for research and I'll get advice for parents and caregivers about how to help your loved one struggling with an eating disorder. Joining us here in studio is Erin Accurso. She's clinical director of the UCSF Eating Disorders Program and assistant professor of psychiatry at UCSF. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Clara Misko with us. She's CEO of the National Eating Disorders Association. Welcome, Clara Misko.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And here in studio with us also is Madeline Dean, a volunteer with Communities of Healing, Project Heal. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And glad to have you all here. And let me begin, if I may, Dr. Accurso, with you. Let's talk about this study. I mean, it kind of upends what we had thought for about four decades, and that's the shocking part of it. What have we learned?
Yeah, I'm really glad to have the opportunity to speak to the study because I think there's been a lot of misreceptions about what we can really understand from what the study was able to answer. So when we look at treatments and we're trying to understand more about what treatments work, we usually compare two different types of treatments. So we have treatment A and we have treatment B, and we hope that one is more effective than the other. And this study actually looked at a compilation of 35 studies that have been done in about the past 40 years. Most of them had been done within the past couple of decades, and it was really looking to compare how well did these sets of treatments do. So we had sort of one group of treatments that was specialist treatments and another group of treatments that was more sort of the comparison condition. And what the study found was that the specialist treatments did a lot better with respect to weight. It was really, those treatments were really, really much more helpful in terms of helping people to restore to a healthier weight. But they didn't really have as much of an impact on psychological symptoms in comparison to some of the comparator treatments.
Has there been a notion somehow that has been persistent that if you reduce weight, you can also reduce the psychological concerns or problems?
No. So we've actually done some research that helps us to understand that when people are restoring weight, it's actually the first thing that is important in terms of helping people psychologically recover. And so it really is sort of the first step in terms of recovery. But I think one of the things that's really challenging about the study is a lot of people have interpreted this to mean that these treatments don't work or that we haven't really learned anything in the past 40 years of research. And that's really not what the study can speak to.
It seems to be interpreted as saying, in effect, that, it's harder to treat than we thought it was, or it's certainly not as efficacious as we thought it was.
Yeah, I think we none of us in the eating disorders field are tremendously surprised by these results, in large part because we know that treatment is really challenging. And we have treatments that can be really effective, but they're not effective for everyone. And I think the variability in outcomes across the studies was really apparent, where some people did really well with some of these treatments, but others didn't. And I think that's a big place for our field to do better, is to figure out which treatments work the best for whom. And I can speak a little bit more to some of the details of the studies that were included that really helped to contextualize the results as well, because again, I think there's been a misperception that the study says that treatments don't work, and that's really not what it's able to answer. It didn't look at the overall efficacy of treatments for for anorexia nervosa. It really looked at sort of the differential effects of some of these specialist treatments to some of these other treatments, you know, many of which were actually, you know, what we would consider to be specialist treatments, like family-based treatment and other kinds of family therapies or cognitive behavioral therapy, which were a part of sort of that the treatment B or comparator types of treatments as well.
Well, Clara Mesko, one of the concerns has been that there's a dearth of research. I mean, research, for example, on anxiety and depression and these kinds of things has gone much farther than eating disorder research.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that at NEDA, the National Eating Disorders Association, we're very focused on. Clearly, we need to understand more about these illnesses and the complexity of eating disorders and the broad spectrum. I mean, when we talk about eating disorders, we're talking about a range of behaviors and levels of severity. We talk about eating disorders as, you know, biopsychosocial, that we need to understand more about the biological, neurobiological underpinnings, the genetic connections. There's certainly a tremendous amount of co-occurrence when we talk about eating disorders with other mental health conditions. And then, of course, we live in a culture that often validates this obsession with perfection and thinness and now fitness. So there are all of these different factors, and we need more research. And the funding for research on eating disorders, you know, when we look at the prevalence, and 30 million Americans will struggle with an eating disorder at some point in their lives. And yet, you know, on average, we're looking at about, less than a dollar per person affected. And that's compared to, you know, around $70 for other major mental health conditions. So we need more research funding. We need more research to better understand these illnesses and help those who are affected.
That 30 million number is staggering. And it's also, I think, important to point out or highlight that the number of women outnumber the number of men 2-1. There's, in fact, a lot of kind of misconceived notions that this is only a disease of women and privileged white women and all that sort of thing. It's a disease that really goes across all racial lines, ethnic lines, and certainly has the number of boys and men, unfortunately, are growing as well. How do we move the needle on this, though? I mean, and particularly in light of the fact that there's a lot of stuff moving into the realm of genetics and neurobiology that suggests maybe some promising research can move that needle.
I think more money and more time. I think, you know, eating disorders are in some ways disadvantaged in terms of learning, because if you were talking about depression, you know, one in five people is going to struggle with depression. And so it's a lot easier to study and to recruit people to understand how treatments work and how the neurobiology works. With eating disorders, if you're talking about anorexia nervosa, which the study spoke to, it's really affecting one in 100 people. So it takes us a lot longer to collect a large enough sample to really understand what to do. And what we do is, you know, what's effective. And so we're able to advance, I think, more slowly than some of the other fields, unfortunately, because of that.
Well, one of the other big obstacles, and let me get you in this, Clara Mesko, is getting insurance coverage. I mean, how people can get help. First of all, they have to get help when they need it, and many of them simply don't, or they don't recognize the symptoms as being as serious and as of concern. But insurance is a big problem.
Yes, it is a huge problem, and we hear about this every day through our helpline. The National Eating Disorders Association runs a helpline at nationaleatingdisorders.org. We get calls, we take chats, and this is a major issue that comes up from people who are contacting us. You know, people who are motivated to seek help and cannot either, because of cost or geography, you know, cannot find treatment or get treatment covered by their insurance companies. So this is another big area for advocacy for us. And you know, as you pointed out, you know, another big barrier is the stereotypes and the stigma. So, you know, when we talk about eating disorders as a major public health issue, we have to talk about, you know, the broad range of people who are affected and really move away from those stereotypes.
There's a big spectrum, and I think you've just intimated that, but also a link to other issues. I mean, anxiety, depression, mm-hmm. substance abuse disorder, you know, all of these are often tied into eating disorders.
Yes, and many people, in fact, most people who contact us and talk about their eating disorder behavior, they're struggling with other issues as well. As you pointed out, anxiety, depression. There's a strong link to substance use. We also hear from people who have experienced trauma. There are communities, all kinds of communities who are affected by these illnesses. So it's important that we really highlight and move away from, as you noted, you know, that typical stereotypical picture of who struggles with an eating disorder. I can't tell you, the number of people who contact us who have waited a very long time to reach out for help because they don't see themselves reflected in the way eating disorders are portrayed in mainstream media. We hear often people say, well, I'm not that sick, or, you know, I haven't lost that much weight. Again, from a public health standpoint, we really need to talk about the range of people who are affected. And as you pointed out, this affects men and women, girls and boys, people of all socioeconomic statuses, people of all races, genders, body size. So busting through those myths is really important as we advocate for better coverage and more research funding.
Well, there's not only research and busting through the myths, there's also the importance of education to ameliorate those kinds of concerns as best they can be ameliorated. And the whole problem of stigma. And we've got also psychological difficulties when, say, a young man or a young woman looks in the mirror and the body image is one, they may be skeletal, but that's not what they see in their mind's eye. And we're going to talk more about eating disorders and about anorexia nervosa specifically. And I want to remind you that we're really trying to not only educate here, but dispel some of these myths that have been, unfortunately, too much a part of this illness, and it is an illness that's difficult often to treat and that can be deadly. Let me invite your calls. You can join us at our toll-free number, and I want to talk about eating disorders. What are your questions, or have you struggled with an eating disorder? You can share your experience with us and let us know what your thoughts are. Our toll-free number is available, and you can join us now at 866-733-6786. That number again for your calls. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also join us, and we invite you to do that by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website and posting any questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I want to bring in Madeline Dean. She's a volunteer with Communities of Healing, Project Heal, and someone who went through eating disorder. Madeline, good to have you, as I said. Let's talk about, well, what you went through. It began when you were 10?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Michael. So, yeah, I can trace the roots of my eating disorder back to my childhood. I would say around age 10, my behaviors didn't get to a really kind of a full-blown point until I was probably 15 years old, but I can definitely trace, like, where that started to childhood.
And you think there's a cause? Why did you go to the eating disorder? I mean, whatever was troubling you could have gone all kinds of different ways, but it went to that. Why?
Yeah, so I do think, and Claire was speaking to this as well, but I do think there's a certain amount of genetic predisposition. Mental illness and addiction have definitely showed up in my family, and they've shown up in other ways before. And so I do think that part of what happened is that this is kind of how it showed up for me. And the
Were you obsessed, though, with being thin? Was that a part of it or
no,
not?
No, you know, it really wasn't about that. And I actually think that that's one of the most damaging misperceptions, is that eating disorders are what we might refer to as a vanity disease. And for me, I know that where it came from was a need to try to control something in my life when I felt like things were out of my control, and that things at home were kind of chaotic. And I was looking for something that I could be in charge of and that I could have some control over.
And that was recognizable at age 10?
It wasn't recognizable, no. I think that around age 10 is when I started to skip meals and kind of get away with some eating disorder behaviors. And it felt like this weird superpower, like this ability that I had to kind of do something that I was, you know, maybe getting away with. And I wasn't identifying that what I was doing was problematic or even really what it was. And then it didn't really get out of control for several years. I think it was kind of this thing that it was there in the background, but it wasn't like a full-blown eating disorder for
Your family knew about it, though?
No. I was a very naturally thin person, and I think that when I was a kid, it wasn't necessarily perceptible, especially like from an outside perspective, from people who were maybe a little distracted by other things that were going on.
But that's fascinating. You wanted above all to be in control of your own body and control of what you put in and consumed and ate and ingested and all that. So when did you feel you needed to go for help, or how did you find help?
Yeah, so I really got deep into my eating disorder in high school, and I was dealing with it for a couple of years before I really knew what it was. And when I was about 18 years old, I realized, it kind of hit me that, like, okay, I think that I might have a problem. And around the same time that I was realizing that, my best friend confronted me about it, because she had been noticing that, like, things were definitely getting to an unhealthy place. And it was interesting because I thought that, you know, okay, great, now I've recognized I have a problem, someone else is aware of it, I'm starting to be open about it, I'll probably just get better and, like, everything will be okay. And that was unfortunately not the case. You know, and we talk in communities of healing about how if it was as easy as just naming that you have a problem and deciding you want to get better, it would be so easy to recover, right? But unfortunately, that isn't the case.
You mentioned communities of healing. Is that a way that you can break through and diminish or maybe even exorcise the problem of anorexia nervosa, do you think?
Communities of healing specifically?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Project Heal is a nonprofit organization that was originally just focused on access to care for people who weren't able to financially afford that care and, like, funding treatment for people. And then we've recently, in the past couple of years, expanded to a program called Communities of Healing, which is a weekly support group that's run by myself and another person in San Francisco. And then there are other groups across the country. And it's this idea that peer support from people who have really struggled can be an integral and really helpful piece of the puzzle for somebody who is currently struggling.
But what personally helped you through your struggle initially? What got you through?
I mean, for me, it really was community. I mentioned my friend who kind of confronted me initially. And then when I went away to college that fall and things started to really spiral out of control, I essentially had a bunch of friends kind of stage an intervention with me and bring it to my attention that they were really concerned and that they needed me to get help. And I know that for me, that was hugely motivating. And it still took me a long time to really fully want to recover, but community was a huge piece of that.
How many years has it been now?
I've been fully recovered for 4 years.
And is it like alcoholism? Can you easily go back or fall back into it? Or is it always there in the background, so to speak?
You know, it's different for everybody. And there's actually a myth that full recovery isn't possible. And it's actually something that was told to me by a therapist when I was really struggling. And that's unfortunately a pretty common thing to hear, that people are being told, like, you know, it may always be there in the background. And I know for me, you know, some of the traits that led to my eating disorder are still part of me because it was me all along. But those traits are, you know, showing up in different ways now. And I do feel fully recovered. I don't feel that I'm dealing with that in the background anymore.
Madeline Dean with us in studio, volunteer with Communities of Healing and with Project Heal. And I've got a listener here who says, I dated someone who had anorexia, and what got her out of it was learning about nutrition. As she learned what her body needed, what created fat, etc., she started to feel more in control. It might just be anecdotal, but does education play a role? Well, certainly it does, Erin Accurso, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think for a lot of people, having more information is really helpful. I would also sort of want to hear Madeline's perspective as well. I think for many people, education may not be sort of everything that they need. And oftentimes they need a lot of support for how to implement the education. Many people with eating disorders know that what they're doing isn't necessarily healthy for their bodies, but it's still really difficult for them to change those behaviors. And I think that's where therapy and nutrition counseling and medical management can come in, of really helping people to figure out what they need to be able to make some of the changes that are really difficult to do.
Well, from what I've read and absorbed, it's often case by case, I mean, individually and so forth. But there's a movement more toward a bottom-up approach, at least, again, from what I've been able to glean. That is getting into weight and body and all of these things in a cognitive way, as opposed to maybe integrating cognitive therapy.
I think that one of the things we've learned is when people are really malnourished, their brains are not, they're not working properly. You know, brains need fat and they need energy to function really well. And so at least especially for a lot of the teenagers that we see, we really focus on helping them to get physically well so they can take advantage of some of the cognitive strategies that we might use. That then they can really, you know, their brain is more fully on board and able to think about different strategies or different techniques that they can use to really help them move forward.
Let me bring a caller aboard here. Rebecca, join us. We'll welcome you.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hear you fine.
Thanks. So my daughter is, you know, pretty solidly into her recovery after many years of anorexia. She spiraled into an eating disorder that became quite evident after her freshman year in high school. And she also had anxiety and perfectionism going on. And she, you know, we went headlong into treatment with her and tried many different things. And, you know, it went on and on for several years. She's now 21 years old and doing really well. But one comment that I have about what I imagine is, you know, a difficulty with research is just that temporal factor of many years going on and developmentally what worked for her sort of in the end after, you know, some very fine residential programs and hospitalizations and refeeding and, you know, everything else ended up being, you know, that Maudsley or family-based therapy where the parents literally take control of the plate and, you know, essentially make all the decisions for the child. That usually works at a young age, 12 or 13. And in our daughter's case, it actually worked at age 18 and 19, which was quite unusual. So I think that that's another factor that it makes research difficult is that the timeline, and especially for teenagers as they're developing, is so long that it's hard to know what will work at what time. And I'll take my any comments.
Yeah, I think it's an important point. Can we go to you again, Erin?
Absolutely. And I'm really glad to hear that story because there have definitely been, you know, more studies looking at that approach, family-based treatment or FBT or Maudsley, in you know, older teenagers and young adults, because that is a treatment that we do find to be one of the most efficacious treatments that we have. And I think it gives a lot of hope that there are many different treatment approaches and not all of the treatment approaches are going to work for everybody. But we do have some really good evidence to support some of those treatments being effective for many people, and then, you know, figuring out how to tailor things if we're finding that those treatments aren't working. And a lot of what we're doing right now at UCSF is trying to tailor some of the treatments and figuring out for those people for whom FBT really doesn't work as well or that they're not responding, are there ways that we can adapt the treatment to really help bring along people who might not otherwise respond to really benefit from the treatment.
As long as we're talking about treatments, we're coming up on a break here, but let me go back to you, Claire Misko, on this. I was looking at something about neuromodulating testing. That's through brain stimulation. There are, in fact, different treatments that are rising up, particularly linked to genetics. There's a whole article in The Guardian about using genes. Quick response, if you could, Claire Misko.
Yeah, I think there's some really exciting research coming out. And again, it really points to the need for us to better understand the, you know, the genetic connection and the neurobiological underpinnings of these illnesses. So I would really echo what Madeline said about full recovery being possible. And there are some really hopeful developments in the research space where eating disorder treatment and dissemination is concerned. So we just have to keep advocating for more research and more funding.
All right. We will continue to hear that. And indeed, it is an important message to get across to you, our listeners. And we'll hear what you, our listeners, have to say as soon as we return. We're talking about anorexia treatment. It hasn't improved in 40 years, according to a UCSF study. But more hope than you might imagine is on the way. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking really broadly about eating disorders, about treatments, about the need for more research, but also specifically focusing on anorexia nervosa. Treatment has not improved over the last four decades, according to a UCSF study. But as I said before we went to the break, there is certainly hope on the way, and that study has been interpreted as being perhaps a lot more bleak than it sounds on the face of it. Erin Accurso is with us, who was involved in the study, clinical director of UCSF's Eating Disorders Program and assistant professor of psychiatry at UCSF. And Madeline Dean has been talking with us as well. She's a volunteer with Communities of Healing and Project Heal and has healed over the last few years from anorexia, which she struggled with. And Claire Misko, also with us by phone, CEO with the National Eating Disorders Association. And I'm getting a lot of questions along these lines, Claire Misko. This is a listener who says, can you define eating disorders a bit more broadly? I know I don't have anorexia or bulimia, but weight is constantly at the forefront of my mind. It leads to depression and feeling worthless. Intellectually, I understand this does not make sense, but these feelings override any other value of accomplishments.
Well, this is such an important point. And when we talk about eating disorders, again, we're talking about a broad range of illnesses, and there are many diagnoses in addition to anorexia. Bulimia is another eating disorder, binge eating disorder, and a number of other diagnosable eating disorders. But what we often hear from, and from people who are contacting our helpline is, again, this range of behavior that might not fit easily into a diagnosis of eating disorder, but yet a person's thoughts and behaviors around food, weight, exercise are having an incredibly negative impact in their lives. And we know that early intervention can make a huge difference in treatment outcomes. So if this is the case, if you're finding that your thoughts about food and weight, your obsession around weight loss, if you're eating secretively, if you're finding that all of these thoughts are leading to your negative impacts in your relationships, you know, that's enough of a sign to reach out for help. And the earlier you can get that help and get into treatment, the better. And we always encourage people. We have a screening tool on our website, which has been taken over 200,000 times in the last year. And it's not a diagnostic tool, but it certainly is will give an indication of whether your thoughts and behaviors are problematic.
Can you give us that website, if you would?
Yes, it's nationaleatingdisorders.org.
And could I also ask you, since you mentioned binge eating disorders, I was struck by the fact that binge eating disorders are highest in Latinos, and I didn't know quite what to make of that. Can you shed some light on that?
Yes, well, that is true statistically. And again, when we're talking about eating disorders broadly, we're seeing similar rates of eating disorders. But, you know, when we talk about the access to care and the number of people who are reaching out for treatment, they're less likely to be in treatment. Again, we're getting back to this importance of busting myths and moving away from the stereotypical picture and understanding that eating disorders, including binge eating disorder, can affect a broad range of people and do.
And we'll bring on our callers, and we begin with Becky. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. And I first just want to thank you for having this program. I lost my mother to bulimia over 30 years ago, and I still find it really difficult to talk about her cause of death when people inevitably ask because she was so young. So I think that there is still a lot of stigma around talking about it, and wanted to echo what one of the panelists said about the misconception of it being just about body image and thinness, that it for her as well was very much about control. So I wanted to ask your panelists to talk maybe about the distinction between or maybe some of the how this study relates or applies to bulimia specifically. And then finally, if there are any resources that they would suggest for family members who are dealing with this or who are still sort of going through the grieving process, finding ways to kind of process it, you know, even decades later. And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. And thank you for those questions. And let me go back to you, Dr. Accurso. Are we talking about bulimia in this study, too?
So no, this study didn't include any of the treatment trials that have been done for bulimia nervosa. So it really can't speak to treatments in those areas. And I think one of the things that has been a little bit more encouraging in our field is that there are more treatment and more treatment options for bulimia nervosa across both adolescents and adults. So I think we're definitely further ahead in terms of treatment for that disorder than we are for anorexia nervosa. But I also think a big part of continuing to make progress is, you know, having conversations about this and dispelling some of the stigma so that people do come forward for treatment. I think one of the things we've seen in bulimia in particular is that, you know, we don't necessarily see as many of these people coming in. And I think part of that may be it may be sort of less noticeable to observers. It can sometimes be a very secretive type of disorder. And unfortunately, I think what that means is a lot of people are sort of, you know, out in the world and they're not getting help for this. And that's it's a big shame. But the fact that Becky's able to come on and share her story about her mother, I think is really powerful and will hopefully encourage other people to be able to speak more openly about this in the same way that we would for cancer and other kinds of illnesses that there's really no stigma per se around cancer and eating disorders really shouldn't be any different.
It's ironic though, because a lot of people associate eating disorders as being eating disorders and kind of separate it from mental illness. And they think of mental illness, they think of schizophrenia or bipolar disorders or things of that sort. Can you make a distinction for us between specialized treatments and controlled treatments?
Yeah, and with this study in particular, I think that distinction is really important because the specialized treatments that were studied here included a broad range of different treatments. So acupuncture was one of the treatments that was in the specialized treatments. There were a lot of medication treatments that were involved in that comparison. And really, we haven't had a lot of good research about medication really being something that's very helpful for anorexia nervosa. So it really included a lot of treatments that are not necessarily that promising. And then the comparison treatments, a lot of the comparison treatments, I think maybe almost half of the comparison treatments, we would actually consider to be specialist treatments. It included things like family-based treatment, FBT, other types of family therapies, CBT. In one of the studies that was included, it actually looked at FBT that was just a larger dose compared to a smaller dose. And so the comparison treatments were actually, many of them were really quite strong treatments. So it's not tremendously surprising that we didn't see a big difference between the impact of those two on psychological symptoms per se.
And Claire Misko, it's difficult to use placebos when you're doing psychological studies, right?
Exactly. It would be unethical,
yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
We have to have credible treatments that we use.
Let me go back to you, Claire Misko, with the caller also asking about resources for the family and so forth. Can you comment?
Sure. Well, certainly the National Eating Disorders Association focuses a lot on supporting families and caregivers. These are illnesses that can be incredibly overwhelming. They do affect the whole family, and those who are trying to provide support and care need to be educated. They need to be supported. I go back to Madeline's earlier point about community, because there's so much isolation and shame. We need to connect and talk about our experiences. And so I really applaud Becky for sharing her story, because it does help to break down the stigma. Everybody knows someone who has been affected by an eating disorder, and yet there still is so much shame and silence and stigma around these illnesses. So I would really encourage, if you know someone, you know, if you're already dealing with a diagnosis, or if you suspect that someone you care about is struggling, you know, to reach out and get information. Again, we run a helpline at the National Eating Disorders Association. We have a parent and family toolkit that's available on our website. Again, we have our screening tool, so lots of resources and ways of connecting with others who understand these illnesses, because, again, they can be very overwhelming and isolating.
And we now have a link to your website just so listeners can go to that and avail themselves of it. And let me go back to you, Madeline Dean. There's a listener who writes, and perhaps since you've been working in capacity with communities and so forth, you might be able to help her. She says, there's a child in my community who I suspect is anorexic, but I've been very hesitant to approach her parents, who are my dear friends, because I'm afraid they'll feel that I'm meddling or suggesting that they haven't been paying attention. Do you have any advice?
Oh, that's such a tough situation. I have so
yes,
much empathy
is.
For everybody.
I don't
involved.
Mean to throw it to you, but
no, that's okay.
I thought you might have some wisdom.
Sure. I mean, I'll just, you know, circle back to my point about how important community can be in recovery. And I think that if this person, you know, feels concern and feels that she can or he can approach the family in such a way that's delicate, but is like voicing that concern to them, it could be that the parents are aware and feel that it's a totally stigmatized thing that they can't talk about. It could be that they're not picking up on the signs or that they're in denial about it. And it's really hard to say. But I definitely always think that having a conversation is preferable to, you know, feeling the impetus to bring it up, but then deciding not to. So I think a brave decision to talk to them about it could be really beneficial.
And a reasonable way to frame something like that, it seems to me, is to say, look, you know, I care about you, and this is why, you know, I don't want to be meddling. In fact, immediately put that out there and don't want to be interfering with your parenting skills, but I'm concerned, and I'm concerned as a friend and as someone who cares about you and your child.
Yeah.
Let me bring some more callers aboard here. Let me get to Sarah next. Sarah, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I am 2 years into recovery from a 3-year struggle with anorexia and also binge eating. And one of the most sort of damaging responses I got once when I tried to confide in someone close to me that I thought that I was struggling with an eating disorder was, but you're not that thin. And so I was wondering if your guests could talk a little bit more about the fact that people who are in average size bodies or fat bodies can still be struggling very severely with eating disorders. I think that's important in terms of breaking down stigma and helping listeners even recognize if they might be suffering from something.
Yeah, Sarah, thank you much for that question. Erin Accurso?
Absolutely. I think one of the unfortunate misperceptions is that people can notice when someone has an eating disorder. And that just really is not the case. There are a lot of people who are struggling with very severe eating disorder symptoms, and they can be at all body shape, weights, and sizes. And I think, you know, part of the stigma of feeling like I'm not sort of sick enough to get help is one of the things that unfortunately gets in the way of people coming in. But you know, eating disorders really don't have anything to do with weight and shape in the way that most people think that they do. People can be struggling at a range of different body weights and sizes, and that still doesn't mean we would still want to help to support them regardless of where they are on the weight spectrum.
And if I can go back to you, Claire Misko, we were talking before about insurance and what an enormous problem it is. And here's Jackie, who writes, when I sought treatment after a relapse at age 33 and my insurance finally agreed to cover my therapy, they made it clear that if I didn't make what they deemed appropriate progress, they would terminate my benefits at any time. The insurance company demanded information weekly, such as weight, copies of my food diaries, notes from therapists. I eventually did complete the entire course of treatment, but it added a layer of anxiety that was not helpful. They also let me know that they would not cover a treatment like this again. Claire Misko?
Yeah, unfortunately, this is a very common story. And again, it's one that really drives us as an organization in our advocacy efforts to try to get, you know, better insurance coverage for people who are seeking treatment. You know, we often hear about the revolving door. People will get into treatment, but then they're booted out by their insurance companies for whatever reason. There's a strong link to, as your previous caller noted, you know, the whole misperception about weight being reflective of health is another big challenge that comes up for people who are trying to seek treatment. So, you know, this is something, and you know, as your caller noted, it's so overwhelming when you're going through this, and then to have this as an added layer of complication and, you know, constant struggle trying to get help. We do have resources at the National Eating Disorders Association. We have an insurance toolkit. We have trained helpline volunteers who really understand the landscape and can help our contacts to navigate what can be a very challenging situation. But, you know, this is another area that unfortunately is all too common.
And here's Una, who is asking for an opinion along the lines that we're talking about, wants to know, do your guests think insurance companies or even society at large would take eating disorders more seriously if they stop being associated with women? Anybody have an opinion they want to put forward on that? Okay, we'll just let the question stand, and we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Fred. Fred, you're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you. I wanted to really echo one of your guests' personal stories about it being a control issue. It seems like some people, for them, it's a weight thing, it's a body image, and others, it's a complete anxiety disorder. It's control. A good friend of mine growing up was from a very large family, and she said that there was fights all the time at the dinner table. There was a lot of stress associated with food, and she became anorexic when she was in her late teens, ended up being hospitalized at 80 pounds, but she was 5'11", so she was completely thin as a rail and wore clothes all the time to cover up the way she looked because she didn't care about the weight. It was the control thing. And she went through therapy, and that's not really what saved her. It was becoming, ironically, obsessed with exercise. And so she got really strong and became a runner and a swimmer and a biker. And that's what really saved her life, not the therapy, not anything else. So it really varies what will actually help you. And I think that's a really interesting thing to look at the genetics of it. Just like there's different kinds of cancers out there and people respond to different treatments. But if they can identify which treatments will work before they waste a lot of time with things that don't work, that can be a fantastic thing to help people, I think.
Well, thank you, Fred, for those thoughts. Good to hear from you. You can't really judge or define good outcomes on the basis of weight alone, can you, Erin Akerson?
No, you really can't. I think it's a necessary part, especially for people who are not in a healthy weight range, to hopefully get into a healthy weight range and medically be in a safe place. But really what we want to help people is with the cognitions and the emotions that come along with eating disorders and really help with some of those psychological symptoms. And I think that's where our field is really needing to work a lot harder on, because I think the needle is moving much slower in that respect.
And did exercise help you, Madeline?
You know, I actually had a pretty unhealthy relationship with over-exercising when I was deep in my eating disorder, which I do think is unfortunately a common aspect of it. I've been able in recovery to really reclaim exercise and to come back to exercise, you know, to certain aspects of exercise that are able to be healthy for me. But there are certain things, like for me, running was something that I had to leave behind and that I'm no longer interested in kind of trying to bring into my healthy life. But yeah, as the caller said, and as, you know, Erin has said as well, like it's really each individual person's experience with recovery is so different. And there's just no one size fits all plan for how to recover or what may help an individual.
There's a comment from Angela, who writes, as someone who was successfully treated for anorexia as a college student years ago, I've come to feel that eating disorders are correlated with anxiety and obsessive-compulsive behaviors. We have a family history of addiction, and food serves that function as well as alcohol. Let me go to more of your calls, and let's go next to
Anahita.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Michael. I really appreciate the fact you guys have this program and this conversation. I think it's really important. I personally struggled with eating disorder most of my adolescence and early 20s. And what I realized with the great support of my family, friends, and great therapists that I had, that it was a coping mechanism for my depression and anxiety that I struggled a lot with. And when I address those issues with and replacing binge eating and other eating disorders with more effective coping mechanisms, it really did help and helped me recover. And I haven't had any issues or relapses since. And so it's more of a comment I want to share with your listeners that perhaps addressing the underlying reasons sometimes can help, and finding better mechanisms to cope with that anxiety or stress can actually overcome the struggle. So,
Anahita, good of you to share that. Yeah, no, we thank you for that, and I hope you continue along the trajectory you're on. Appreciate hearing from you. I'm going to read a comment now by a listener named Monique, who I think makes an important point, too. She says, my first thought on hearing about anorexia is, I wish I had that disorder. I know that it's a serious problem, but I think an attitude like that may be part of why there isn't more funding for research. People don't take it seriously because it's a disorder of vanity, they think, and therefore not a problem deserving of being taken seriously. You're nodding your head, Erin or Kirsten.
It's such a common misperception and such a problem with I think people feeling like they can come forward for eating disorders treatment.
Naomi Wolf, the beauty myth. I mean, that's really what it was all about in so many respects. How I see myself in the mirror, how I look, and how my body comes back to me in the mirror, and therefore I have to stay skinny. And it becomes, in many people's minds, all about beauty, vanity, and looking good.
Yeah, and what we know from research, from understanding more about the neurobiology of eating disorders, is that's really not what it's about. And also, anorexia nervosa in particular is the deadliest disorder of all of the psychiatric disorders. It's not a thing about vanity, and nobody would choose to have this disorder who has it. It's not something that anybody would want to have in their life because it's disruptive to everything, all of their goals and values. And I think one of the callers spoke to the fact that their goals and values were really surpassed by having an eating disorder. And nobody would choose to give up everything that matters to them.
Well, when we talk about how lethal it is and how deadly it is, how big a factor is suicide in that? How much does that figure in?
It's a huge part of the mortality rate. There are medical complications that impact that, but the suicide rate for anorexia nervosa is higher than depression. It's higher than a lot of the other psychiatric illnesses because I think it speaks to the fact that people are so distressed and they're so miserable with having an eating disorder that they really don't want to continue living.
Were you at all suicidal, Madeline? Just ask you. Bluntly?
No, I wasn't, but I also experienced a lot of thoughts that I would identify later as like not my own. And I think that something we talk about a lot in the recovery community is the idea of like a healthy self and an eating disorder self, and that there's this huge part of your brain when you're really struggling that can be kind of like driving and might be telling you things that are absolutely not true and kind of indicating like what you should do or what you shouldn't do. And I think that, you know, that definitely plays into anxiety and plays into depression and just kind of that link between like, you know, are you able to trust your own thoughts? And I wasn't suicidal, but I definitely had a lot of thoughts that, you know, I really couldn't trust that they were actually true.
We're talking about eating disorders, specifically about anorexia, talking with Erin Accurso of UCSF and Clara Misko of the National Eating Disorders Association and Madeline Dean of Project HEAL. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let's go to Pleasant Hill. And Michael, we welcome you. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. So I had a question about the kind of the opposite effect of of that anyway, of eating disorders where you overeat or what have you. But I think I have more of an disorder where I undereat. I'll get stressed and, you know, depressed or what have you, and I'll move forward 2 days at a time without eating at all, to where I almost get upset at the fact that I need to eat.
Claire Misko, can I get you to comment on that? We were talking before about binge eating, but just about what we heard from Michael describe as his own malady.
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to commend Michael for reaching out and sharing what he's been going through. That's certainly a major first step. If you are concerned about your behavior, I would encourage you to seek help for that. The fact that it's something that sounds like it's been ongoing, is important enough. Again, that's enough of a sign to reach out for help. And there are a range of ways that these illnesses present themselves. But if it's interrupting your life and, causing you stress and anxiety, that's enough of a sign to get some help.
What about the role, and let me go to you on this, Claire, of social media and all this, not only in terms of societal beauty, but there was, I don't know if you're familiar with it, a whole brouhaha with Instagram putting up skeletal figures and saying, in effect, in many people's minds, that this is the way to achieve glamour or something along those lines, that really offended people and thought it was encouraging people to fall into eating disorders. Some thoughts from you?
Sure. Well, this is certainly a hot topic. We are asked often about the role of social media in eating disorders. Certainly it's not a black and white issue. We don't talk about social media causing eating disorders. But certainly some of what's happening in social media can amplify some of the thoughts and behaviors that are linked to eating disorders. Perfectionism, the drive to compare yourself in a social media space, you're quite literally racking up likes. And so for someone in that mindset, that can be, you know, that can be really troubling, and it can further entrench those thoughts. You know, also, as you noted, we're really faced with an onslaught of images. I mean, when I think about, you know, when I was a teenager, it was looking at images in a magazine, a physical magazine. You know, now we have a constant stream of images and messages that reinforce, you know, perfection, and can, as you said, sometimes really glamorize the very, very dangerous aspects of eating disorders. So, you know, we need to really talk about that. And I think for people who are in recovery or actively struggling with eating disorders, we encourage them, you know, first of all, social media might not be good for your recovery. If you do want to interact in social media, you know, think about how you curate your feed. What are the accounts you're following? If you're seeing an account whose images are constantly, you know, triggering negative thoughts for you, you can unfollow that account. So, you know, in a really basic way, you know, that's one thing that we encourage. And then, you know, we also really think about how we can use social media in a positive way to encourage more realistic, more diverse images and messages. And also, you know, for people in recovery, we have a very, very strong pro-recovery community at NIDA, and a very engaged social media community. And, you know, again, to Madeline's point about really connecting with others who get what you're going through, you know, that can be a positive. But again, it's very individualized, and it really depends on where you are in your own recovery journey.
And Claire Misko is CEO of the National Eating Disorders Association, NEDA. And here's another caller. Bettina joins us. Bettina? Welcome.
Hi,
go ahead. Briefly, if you
can.
Okay,
I'm somebody that's been dealing with it since, I'm in my 40s now, but been dealing with eating disorder since probably my late teens. My background was that I went to a boarding school and it was all girls, and that's all we talked about, you know, was food. So we became very obsessive with it. There was also a part that I don't think has been talked about, that the competitive nature as well. I know that amongst all of us, it was like this competitive drive to see who could eat the less sort of situation. My question was about how does somebody like myself who's, you know, going through, I say that I live a regular life now, but it's still on my mind all the time. But how can I help out? Like, is there a community group that somebody like me without any training, but somebody who's experienced it?
Yeah, you've come to the right place here. I think Madeline Dean can give you some information here. Madeline?
Yeah, thanks so much for that comment. So if you want to go to theprojectheal.org, we have a lot of information about Communities of Healing, which is a peer support group, and we have it in several cities across the country and hoping to expand soon. So definitely always excited to hear from people who want to get involved.
Anything to add, Claire Misko, to this caller or those seeking
help?
Well,
I would just... Yeah. Yeah, again, I would encourage her to go to nationaleatingdisorders.org. You know, we also really value people who are in recovery and able to provide hope.
Thank you all. We're going to have to end it there. Claire Misko, Madeline Dean, Aaron Accurso, and you, our listeners. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.